Some 158 million people in the U.S. can expect a payment from the federal government, likely in January. It's part of a $900 billion pandemic relief package Congress passed earlier this week. We're covering that and the latest news in money. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and there's a line for your economic questions. Don't use the phone this morning. Instead, let's work on email. Ideas@WPR.org is the email to send your note. What questions do you have for an economic expert? We're talking about workforce and small business and stimulus payments. Go ahead and send us your question to ideas@WPR.org, and we'll do our best to get it incorporated into the show. Patty Hirsch is the editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. He's been an economics and finance news correspondent and editor for 20 years. Patty, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me back, Keeley. How are you?
Good, thank you. Looking at this stimulus bill, starting next week, many Americans are expected to get a $600 stimulus check from the federal government. Help us understand what we know about who is getting this money and who isn't.
It's a very good question. I mean, you know, this bill is 5,593 pages long, so I haven't had the chance to read it. But then
not
that
the
only just
yet.
Makes me like most of the members of Congress, you know?
True.
It's tough to tell, actually. I mean, there are some parameters in there that means that wealthier people won't get the money that they got in the past. I mean, there was a sliding scale that meant that only a certain proportion of the population, the earning population, didn't get their $1,200 check. The same will apply here. I think the parameters are more strict, which means that the money will hopefully go, these checks will hopefully go to people who really need it, as opposed to people who would probably just save it or just spend it in the economy, although that's also important. I mean, we really skipped to the provisions that are there for small businesses, because that's what we care about most. Small businesses have been absolutely hammered by COVID. They got really poorly treated under the CARES Act originally because the Paycheck Protection Program actually allowed vast quantities of money to funnel to large businesses who didn't really need it. You know, for example, a small steak restaurant would really find difficulty getting some of that money, whereas a large restaurant like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, for example, not that I don't love Ruth's Chris, actually benefited from that in a way that these small businesses couldn't. So there's been an adjustment to that, which is what we are really have been focused on.
When you're looking at those small businesses, is it too late? What else can the government do at this point if they missed out on that first round of real help?
Well, for some small businesses, it is too late. I mean, for example, we've been covering a story over the last 8 months of an urban day spa in Brooklyn, New York. This is a woman who got the Paycheck Protection Program and used it in the way that it was supposed to be used. She basically had a choice. She could either take the loan in a way that it would be forgiven and just channel all of her money towards furloughing her staff, or she could take the loan and not be forced to pay it back by using it not for paycheck protection, but actually for paying the rent, which was her largest overhead. And as a result, you know, she took the loan that she'd be forgiven, paid off her staff, but in the end, she was killed by her rent. Now, a lot of companies found themselves in that position, and a lot of them have gone out of business as a result, because as we know, rent payments are huge. It's very, very difficult to get rent forbearance from a commercial landlord, because they themselves probably owe a mortgage to a bank, and the banks are putting them under pressure. So that chain of events has really affected small businesses in a really deleterious way. But this new Paycheck Protection Program actually is a lot more flexible in that way, or so it appears in the reading. So it means that small businesses should be able to get a better lifeline than they had previously.
To the tune of something like $280 billion for the country. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, $285 billion. It's a lot of money. But when you think about how many small businesses there are in this country that are struggling right now, and you know, add to that number now, or not just add to it, but really focus on restaurants, which are in an incredibly powerless position right now because, you know, they've, in many parts of the country, they've been restricted from outdoor dining, as in California. Then they've been restricted from indoor dining. Now they've been restricted to only producing, you know, food for takeout. You know, these companies are going down like flies, these small independent restaurants. So we really need that money for those employers, because those are huge employers of some of the most part of the population that is most threatened by this situation, both in terms of the sickness, because, you know, they're working as servers and they're liable to get it more easily than other people. Secondly, because of the way that they live, because they tend to be people further down the income scale, which means they tend to live in apartments or in housing where they're packed together. There are more people per square foot in their houses than in like for wealthier people, you know. And thirdly, because you know they are. They're poorer, you know. It's they have to use public transport. They have to use, you know, they are gathering in a way that actually makes them much more vulnerable. So, you know, employees of restaurants, employees in that part of the service industry are particularly vulnerable. So it's really, really important that we channel money to those businesses to keep them employed so that we're not going to find when we actually do get into recovery that these people are not able to get jobs because their businesses are closed.
Yeah, that's certainly happening here in Wisconsin. We know of dozens of restaurants, even just in the Madison area, that are closed permanently. We're talking with Patty Hirsch, who's the editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. And we're taking your thoughts, your experiences over email this morning. You can send a note to ideas@WPR.org. Maybe you're a small business owner. Help us understand how the pandemic has affected you or your work. Maybe you are a woman who's had to drop out of the workforce since the start of the pandemic. We're going to talk about the job market and what's led to those decisions. Share your experience or your question with us via email at ideas@WPR.org. Patty, we're going to move on to some of those other topics, but we do have a couple of questions in that email about those stimulus checks that I want to go through quickly. We have one email that asks, what good does one stimulus check do? Some of us are working way fewer hours and are self-employed and can't even collect unemployment. What does a single stimulus check to a single family do for the economy, Patty, or for them?
Well, the short answer is, in a situation like that, not much, I'm sorry to say. You know, let's be honest about these checks. You know, in many cases, they're going to people who don't need them. All right. You know, people who are already employed and in some cases are employed in jobs that may have even given them a raise recently. So they don't need an extra $1,200 or $600 in this case. In some cases, they're going to people who are in debt, right? They've got serious debts. And because the checks will go into the bank, then the bank will just take that money and, oh, yes, they'll just pop it into, you know, paying off debt. So it actually just benefits the banks in that case. You know, and if you are somebody who has been laid off or has been, you know, is, say, self-employed, for example, and therefore is not able to get unemployment for whatever reason, then you're not getting the supplemental unemployment. And then all you're getting is a $600 check, and you've got a family of four or five or whatever number, and you've got to feed that family. $600 is not going to go very far. So frankly, for people like that, you know, it's, and for whoever wrote in, it sounds like they might be in that situation. Unfortunately, the $600 does not do much. But you know, the government will turn around and say, well, it's better than nothing at all, which I guess is true. But, you know, the problem with a response like this, the CARES Act and this extension to the CARES Act that the government puts out, it's very, very nonspecific. It's like, you know, trying to nail a very small nail, you know, with a car. You know, it's really, really nonspecific. It is not a, this is a very blunt instrument that we're using to try and solve this problem.
And so then we'll have to see what an actual effect on the economy is, depending on how people use those one-time payments, knowing that they are just one time. Patty Hirsch is breaking down what's going on with our money this hour. And we are taking your questions along the way. Email them to ideas@WPR.org. What questions do you have about the economy? Average disposable income is rising in the U.S. somehow. How have your finances changed since the start of 2020? Is your experience really different? How do you think the incoming presidential administration will affect our economy? Go ahead and send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. We'll try to get your question or your comment on the air as we talk with Patty Hirsch about all things economics and the systems we have in place. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for listening here on The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our guest is Planet Money's Patty Hirsch, who's game for all of your questions about the economy and business. Join in now by sending an email to ideas@WPR.org. Small business owners, how has this pandemic affected you and your work? Do you think there's something the federal or state government could have done to support you better or could do now? What questions do you have about how our systems work and how the different layers of it affect one another, from incomes to government systems? Now is the time to ask your question at ideas@WPR.org. The big department stores are running holiday ads for their biggest sales of the season or the year or whatever they happen to claim it is. And like those soft, fluffy pajamas may still catch the eye, but the festive sweaters or the fancy dresses, they just don't seem as relevant when people are spending their time either in uniforms because they're essential workers during this pandemic or in leggings and T-shirts. So, you know, we have a fairly important question, actually, that seems kind of superficial. First, Patty, is the business suit over?
What a great question. I've got several suits in my closet. I haven't touched those in years because I've been working from home for a while. And I think a lot of people are now are in that situation, you know, because they've been working from home for the last 8 months. You know, all these people in finance and accounting and legal, you know, who have realized that they don't need to be in an office, which means they don't need to put on a suit, which means that those suits molder in the closet. That means they don't need to go out shopping for suits. And I think what we're going to see, because we've heard that workers in general have said that they want people who, you know, professional services workers, the type who would wear a business suit, have said in general that they would like to work 3 days out of five from home as opposed to in the office. That's this poll that's been taken across the United States. And that means that if they're not going to go into the office, they're not going to need as many suits, which means you are going to see a real dearth of sales for business suits. You're actually already seeing this. I mean, we've seen so many companies that are dedicated towards the business suit fail recently. We have Brooks Brothers, for example, Men's Warehouse, Tailored Brands, which owns Jossé Bank, and Taylor, all filed for bankruptcy. And this company Express, which is very focused on business suits, it was already shrinking prior to COVID. It's also talking about needing additional finance to serve to keep its doors open. We just saw that news the day before yesterday. So, you know, these companies that sell these suits are already seeing real problems. And I think that you're going to see that across the, a trend that's actually already been expanding across the United States, we're going to see it really play out that, you know, you're not going to need a suit in the office anymore, or very, very rarely. Only people who are sort of client facing, bankers and lawyers, that kind of thing. Most everybody else, they're going to be in, you know, hopefully not jeans and sweatshirts, because I'm a little formal myself, but maybe, you know, chinos and collared shirts.
Well, even on video calls, I mean, it really only, we see so much, so many people laughing about how it really only requires half of an outfit. As long as you look good from the waist up, you know, you don't need to worry as much about if you're wearing jeans or something else. And if we're doing more remote work, we're just less likely to buy it. Even if I buy a new suit jacket, I might not buy the matching slacks that go with it because I don't need them.
Yeah,
that
you don't need them. What's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is, you know, it sounds like an amusing thing to us. It's like, oh, we don't need to wear suits. It's actually a real problem for the fashion industry. They're really kind of struggling to find out what is actually going to fill that gap. But like I say, you know, this is something that's been ongoing for many, many years. I mean, we have seen, you know, I remember whenever I was, relatively younger, the advent of casual Friday. It was like, well, what is this? It's like, you know, you don't have to be in a suit on Friday. And that has just sort of bled through workplaces over the last 20 years. And this is really just the final, I'm not sure it's a nail in the coffin exactly. You still see suits, like I say, people who are in client service, client-facing industries, they'll still need those suits. But for the most part, I think we are really seeing a demise there.
Remote work is not just affecting the fashion industry. This and social distancing, they've been hard on commercial real estate. What kind of legacy do you see COVID-19 leaving on that?
Well, you know, in many ways, it's the same thing, right? You know, if you don't need to, you don't need a business suit because you don't need to go into an office, and you don't need to go into an office because you're all working from home. So now a company's sitting there thinking, huh, we've got all of this real estate in downtown Manhattan or downtown Seattle or downtown Los Angeles or, you know, downtown Minneapolis or wherever it is. And we don't need that real estate because we're sending all these people, you know, all these people are working from home. So maybe we should not have that real estate at all. Maybe we should sell it up, or maybe we should reduce it by a third or two thirds or three quarters or whatever it is. you're seeing that playing out right now in urban areas right across the country. You've got companies renegotiating their real estate contracts, their leasing contracts, and you're seeing leases that have then ended and rolled over and coming up for renewal are not being renewed. You go into any urban city center now, and it's incredible how sparse these places are. We did a story out of Boston recently that we were able to walk around and, you know, shout across the street to people, and they were able to have a conversation, you know, whereas usually those streets would be packed with people and traffic. And commercial real estate has really taken a big ding here. And it's a real problem for commercial real estate owners or people who are in that commercial real estate business, because people who lease commercial real estate to companies, they also have a mortgage, by and large, that they owe to a bank. And the banks are saying, you know, because we're seeing this tightening up in commercial real estate, it's more risky for us. So therefore, we're less likely to lend money to these commercial real estate companies, which means that commercial real estate companies themselves are going out of business. The bad guys, as a lot of people like to tar them, are going out of business. And so you're seeing this ripple effect through commercial real estate that could last for many years, because these leases tend to last for so long.
We're talking about things that have happened this year, even in these last couple of weeks, in economics with Patty Hirsch. She's an economics and finance news correspondent. And we're taking your questions through email today. You can send us a note at ideas@wpr.org. How do you think the incoming presidential administration will affect our economy? What questions do you have for someone who looks at how all of these different factors are intertwined? Maybe you've got something to say about the job market, if you've lost your job or are dealing with a different number of hours and are having to make different financial decisions. You can share those with us at ideas@wpr.org. Patty, the indicator recently looked at something that I do find surprising, that this year average disposable income is on pace to rise at the fastest rate in more than 35 years. How is that possible?
It's incredible, isn't it? So disposable income, right, is the money that you make from your job or money that you get from the government after you subtract taxes that you have to pay. So it's income that you have available to you actually to spend if you want to, right? And that has gone up. So it's like, how can that be during a pandemic? It seems totally counterintuitive. But it's one of those really interesting indicators where if you look behind the numbers, it tells you something really interesting. And that what it tells you is about the bifurcation in the economy right now. So one of the things about the CARES Act, of course, is that it distributed a lot of money. We've just talked about that a little bit. And a lot of people got checks in the mail, large checks of $1,200. So that money, for many people, it was, you know, money that they were able to sort of, because they, you know, didn't actually have to use it immediately, to survive, because as I say, it's a very, very blunt instrument, the CARES Act, or certainly was. These people had suddenly a lot more disposable income because it was on top of their regular salary. They hadn't been laid off. They were still in a job. In some cases, they were getting more money because they're in vital jobs. So this is just extra money that they can spend, right? Remember, some workers in key industries over the last 8 months have gotten raises. The other thing is, of course, that the CARES Act gave people an unemployment boost, right? So some people actually were making more money unemployed than they were making when they were in work. So that was extra money that they could spend. And then, of course, you had people that were saving that money too. So people were just socking that money away, but it was recorded in tax filings and all the rest of it as money that or tax speculation as money that was, you know, able to, that they could spend, that was disposable income. Of course, now, this number is an average, and a lot of people were not in that situation. A lot of people didn't get those checks, you know, immigrant families, for example, especially if they were undocumented. A lot of people were unemployed but were not able to get unemployment, so they didn't get that unemployment bump. So you've seen this bifurcation in the economy. But net-net, because it is an average, it meant that disposable income actually did rise, which is, you know, complete, as I say, completely counterintuitive. Of course, one of the things that we're hoping is that once everybody has the vaccine and once the economy starts to reopen, people who saved that money will then start to spend that money. And that will hopefully give the economy a bit of a boost as well. So that is, you know, so when we were talking about what's the use of a $600 check, well, we're hoping that it is in some degree going to stimulate the economy itself in a wider sense. And that's part of the business of Congress, was try to get money into the economy, try to turn the spigot on, try to get people spending, try to keep those businesses open.
Right. But you can turn the spigot on, but you can't make sure that the water flows to the right places.
You're absolutely right. And that was the problem with the First Cares Act, is that a lot of the money didn't go into the right places. It went into the pockets of large corporations. It went into the pockets of the banks. It did not go into the pockets of small businesses in the way that people wanted it to. It did not go into the pockets of individuals in the way that we wanted it to. And that was the biggest problem with that initial bill. We're hoping that this new act, that the new, if it actually does get across the president's desk and is signed, that money will start to go to the right parts of the economy. You're right, that is exactly the problem. But again, this is a very, very blunt instrument. It's really, really hard to tweak it so that the money goes exactly where it needs to go.
We're just halfway through this hour focused on money and economics. Patty Hirsch with NPR's The Indicator from Planet Money is taking questions and walking us through the latest financial news, breaking it down and helping us understand how it affects our lives. There's time for your question at ideas@WPR.org. We're going to skip the phones today and use our email address. So send your question or your experience to ideas@WPR.org. Some things to think about. Maybe you're a small business owner. Do you think that there's something the government could do to help you better now? Is it too late for you? Tell us what's happening in your part of Wisconsin. Maybe you frequent small businesses. What does your main street look like now, this far into a pandemic that has required social distancing and closures? You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. The pandemic is undermining women's careers. Numbers from the government show that the number of women leaving the workforce is quadruple the number of men dropping out of the job market in this pandemic. We're talking about that and taking your questions here on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Our guest has covered economics for more than 20 years. Patty Hirsch is the editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. And you're welcome to join this discussion. Email ideas@WPR.org. What questions do you have about the economy, about business? Maybe you're a small business owner, or you are looking at your own finances. Maybe you have a question about the broader systems and how they work together. Send us an email. That's the best way to get us your question. Go to ideas@WPR.org, and we'll try to get to your question. I do want to talk about women in the workforce, Patty, because in September, numbers from the Labor Department showed women were leaving the workforce at four times the rate of men. Do we know why that's happening?
Well, there are a bunch of reasons, and it is a really bad indicator because women have been such an important part of the workforce and the growth in the workforce over the last, 20 years and 10 years in particular. And it's been very, very important for Republican administrations to have women in the workforce. So, you can bet that people on both sides of the aisle are concerned about this. But, women are in an impossible position at this point, right? It's like, in many cases, they have to make a decision about their children's health and education versus their own careers. I mean, if they're in a job, and these are women that have not been laid off, by the way. These are women that have actively decided to leave the workforce. If you have children and your husband works or your partner works, if you have children and those children are not able to go to school, which effectively acts as childcare for many women and for many families, the fact is that somebody's going to have to look after those children. Who's that going to be? It's probably not going to be the husband, which in most cases still in the United States is the major breadwinner in any kind of nuclear or conventional family. So it's the woman who has to stop working and has to go and look after the kids. Also, children's health. If you're going to make a decision, if a child gets sick, who's going to stay behind? It's probably not going to be the man. It's probably going to be the woman. And as a result, because kids get sick and they get sick quite a lot, and if you have a large family, then you get more kids getting sick, they have to make this decision to leave in order to look after their families. And this is, of course, cultural precedent, which is unfortunate, but that is where we are. And that's one of the biggest reasons. The other reason is that, women feel less valued in the workforce in many cases. They look around, they're like, I'm in this job. The men in this job are more valued than the women are. So I'm probably going to get paid less. My opportunities for advancement are probably going to be less even today. So they're looking around, they're making a calculated decision. Then they're like, probably it's probably best for me to leave. And so they're quitting. And as you say, quitting in such large numbers now that is going to be a really, really bad hangover to this pandemic over the next 5 to 10 years.
I appreciate the fact that you bring up those different factors, because I do think that although we can show study after study that shows that even though men and women are both working, women pick up more of the domestic duties and there is a gender pressure there, there are people who get a little bit defensive and say, you know, I'm a man, I contribute just as much to my household and my family as you know, my partner, a woman, does. And so don't put that on me. And yet there's still that financial calculation. That even if you do really split the duties 50-50, the likelihood that the man in a relationship makes more means sometimes it's just like math to figure out who should stay home and who can keep working.
Exactly right. And the math very rarely now, or I mean, I think more often than it used to, but still, just because of the way we are culturally, the math tends to run in the man's favor in this case. And, you know, that is just something that we're seeing playing out. It's just... It's the way that it is. One of the things that is quite interesting about the pandemic is the importance of nurses. And of course, we know that in the caring professions, women tend to dominate in those professions. There are just less men there. So there have been some aberrations in the data where you've seen women who are nurses getting paid way more than male partners in a family, because they're in so much demand. I mean, we've seen some incredible hikes in nursing salaries and nursing pay in certain parts of the country as a response to COVID, as the nursing population has become so much in demand. But even in nursing, you know, you're starting to see women leave because they are saying to themselves, look, this is a really, really high pressure job. I've got a family to look after. I'm doing so much of the domestic work at home. Again, I need to prioritize my kids. So even in a situation like that, where a woman might be getting paid more, in many cases, they are still making that decision to forego that paycheck, drop out and look after the family because they see their role there is so important. So the cultural expectations of women just doesn't just happen on the male side. It also happens on the female side. It's like we're all kind of hidebound by this, or many of us are hidebound by this this cultural legacy that we have, that, you know, that in many cases can be toxic, but still is a hangover for us today.
I mean, so then what happens? You have women dropping out of the workforce. It takes them years to get back into it. They're not paid as much as if they'd been able to stay in the workforce and earn raises or get promotions. Sounds like it sets women back.
It certainly sets women back. I mean, this is the big problem, is that if women drop out of the workforce in these numbers, right, and they stay out of the workforce for, you know, an extended period of time, like say a couple of years, then institutionally, we're getting back to the old days, right, where workforces are dominated by men. And many men are inevitably going to be looking at the situation going, well, you know, these women didn't hack it. They all left. They left us running the company. Is it worth us employing women? This is a horribly toxic thing to be happening. But you know that that's what's going to be in many people's minds, in the same way that people used to look at women and say, well, we're not going to hire her because she's going to get pregnant in 5 years. In many cases, that old conditioning may return. So it's not just let's get women trained up and back into the workforce. It's not a practical thing. It's almost a psychological thing where we're setting ourselves back. And I think that is a really unfortunate and toxic place for us to be.
Paddy Hirsch is with us this morning. He's the editor of the Planet Money podcast called The Indicator. And we are taking your thoughts, your questions about economics at ideas@WPR.org. We are relying on email this morning to get your questions answered. So don't hesitate. Go ahead and type that up right now. Let us know what questions you have, what your experiences are in the job market or dealing with small businesses, or where you want this to see government step in and help, or if you think that the government should stay hands off and let the economy do what it does. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Patty, the Indicator actually looked at hospitals across the country that are scrounging for healthcare workers right now. You just mentioned, you know, the nurse piece of that. There just aren't enough people who are trained and skilled at this to go around in this pandemic. What is the scope of the problem?
Well, it depends on where you are, of course, right? You know, so if you're in a state like California or a state like New York, you're in real trouble because just of the way the virus works. If you're in heavily populated states where the population is crammed into dense areas, the virus spreads that much more quickly. And so if you're in those areas, you know, those intensive care units are being absolutely you know, mobbed by people. I mean, I think we heard it in the news break how the effect that we've seen on intensive care units and indeed on hospitals generally. Of course, that means there's more demand for nurses. But of course, a lot of these nurses are, you know, they are themselves under pressure. I mean, we heard in recently in North Dakota that there's so much pressure on nursing there. There's so much demand for nurses, and the hospitals are so under-resourced in terms of staffing that the governor of North Dakota turned around and said, look, if you are a nurse and you test positive for COVID, but you are asymptomatic, you're not showing symptoms, you still have to go back to work. So you can imagine how nurses feel in that situation. We spoke to one who said, you know, they feel like they're, you know, almost like a, you know, like a cog in a machine. It's almost like a redundant thing. Oh, you know, that cog will fail and we'll just get another one. Of course, you can't get another one because there just aren't enough nurses. And when I mentioned, you know, nurses getting paid more, these tend to be traveling nurses. These are nurses that are willing to travel in order to work in different places. In many cases, their pay has doubled or even tripled in some cases because there is so much demand. Of course, in other parts of the country, they have not been so overwhelmed. Their hospitals are not in so much trouble, so they have more capacity there. But of course, nobody wants to release their nursing staff in those situations because you just never know where the virus is going to strike and whether or not your own hospital is going to be overwhelmed. So it's a really, really difficult situation for hospitals right now. The other issue for hospitals, of course, is that looking after COVID patients is not a moneymaker, frankly. Yeah. You know, the moneymaker, the places where hospitals make money are in those, you know, looking after cancer patients, you know, elective surgeries, you know, all those types of things. People who sort of break their legs and, you know, need to have the bones reset in an expensive way. Those are the moneymakers, but they're not making that sort of money because their beds are full of COVID patients. So hospitals are really finding their bottom lines being eroded by the pandemic as well. And that's a really serious situation because if we start to see hospitals going out of business, then we're going to be in real trouble.
The COVID-19 vaccine is being rolled out. How do you think that could affect the pace of our economic recovery?
Well, I think it'll be, forgive the expression, a real shot in the arm for the economy, right? I mean, you know, as soon as people start getting vaccinated in large numbers, they're going to be much more confident about doing the things that they used to do and going out and spending their money, which is really, really important for the economy. Of course, you know, I live in Southern California. A big part of the economy here is the restaurant business. So as soon as those restaurants start to reopening, then you're starting to really reinvigorate the economy. Firstly, because people are spending their money in the restaurant. You're starting to see the money flowing through. But also because, of course, those restaurants employ workers. And once those workers are employed and back to work, then they start spending as well. And they're spending in stores and, you know, amusement parks or whatever. So now Disney's amusement park can open back up again. So, you know, it's the fact that once people are able to gather and work and, you know, live normally again, the economy will start. It'll be literally like, you know, breathing oxygen into a patient who has, you know, just come out of an airlock in space. I mean, that is how dramatic that recovery is going to be. Of course, it all depends on how quickly we can roll out that vaccine and how effective that vaccine proves to be across the United States. So it's a big ask for the government to get the vaccine out there as quickly as possible to get us working in the way that we used to.
Yeah, not just for health and safety, but for economic recovery. We're talking with Patty Hirsch of NPR's The Indicator with us to discuss what's on your mind when it comes to the economy. Don't delay. Give us an email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll try to get it answered as Patty stays with us for a bit longer this morning. He's been with us this hour taking things through. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and thanks for being with us here on the Ideas Network. We're taking on the latest in economic and financial business news, figuring out how it makes a difference in our everyday lives. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Right now on the Ideas Network, we're talking with Patty Hirsch from the NPR podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. And there's still time for your question. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Help us understand what's on your mind when it comes to economics, and we'll see if we can get an answer. We do have a couple of emails here, Patty, and we're going to circle back to the government stimulus money. Peggy in La Crosse says, with so many businesses and charitable organizations in need, how about encouraging people who aren't in need themselves to donate their stimulus money to support these entities? Would that help us economically, Patty?
Yes, I think it would help us. I think Peggy's absolutely on the money here, as it were. I mean, you know, it's people are getting if people are getting checks that they don't need, why not give that check to somebody who actually really does need it? I mean, that's an absolutely reasonable question. I think that it should be. I personally believe that this is very much a personal view. I personally think that that would be a good idea, because if you give the money to someone who needs it, that person will spend that money. So even from a selfish perspective, from an economics perspective, that's a smart thing to do, because the one thing that that money is supposed to do is supposed to be going back into the economy to stimulate the economy. I mean, this money is literally like a blood transfusion, right? So the government is giving the economy a huge blood transfusion in the form of these various programs, like whether it be the Paycheck Protection Program or the $600 check, whatever it is. It's trying to get money. That's why it's called a stimulus package. It's trying to get money into the economy in any way it can. And if you give a $600 check to someone who really doesn't really need it, and that person puts that money in the bank, that's frankly no good. All right, that is not helpful. Right, what you want to do is to get that money to someone who needs it, who will spend that money in whichever store it happens to be, or restaurant, or retailer, wherever it happens to be, so that money will go through it, so the blood is literally pumping through the economy. So I think that, personally, I think that donating money, if you don't need it when you get it from the government, is an excellent idea. And it would be great to see written on that check, underneath whatever signature's on it. I know the president wanted to have his signature on the first bunch of checks, but it would be great to see, hey, if you get this money and you don't really need it, please give it to someone who does. I think that's an excellent idea, Peggy. Hmm. Go for it.
Thanks again for that email, Peggy. We also have a note from Mary. Mary says they're on a local and rural revolving fund committee in Northwest Wisconsin. Mary says they have money remaining in the fund to loan on good terms to small businesses. And Mary assumes that, you know, there may be other areas across the U.S. that have what could total, I mean, millions of dollars that could help small businesses. And Mary wants to get the word out to urge the application of small businesses to those other options. I mean, Patty, Mary is right in that the government is not the only place that small businesses could find support.
She's absolutely right. But let's not forget, and I don't mean a but here, let's not forget that small businesses are working incredibly hard to keep their doors open, right? They've got a lot going on. And information is, it's all over the place. The information is everywhere. It's really, really, it's tough for them to get a sense of where they can get money, because there's no centralized place to get that information. It's really, really unfortunate that government isn't able to operate in an effective way in this way by providing people with a list of resources. Look, if you here's the PPP loan. If you can't get this, or if you don't want to use this, here's another type of loan. Here's somewhere else you can go for money. Here's somewhere else you can go for money. It's really unfortunate that we don't have that kind of infrastructure in place. But it is very, very heartening to know that there are institutions out there that are offering these kinds of loans. Of course, a lot of the time, it depends on what the terms of the loans are. And, you know, it's really, really important that, you know, the terms are generous enough in the situation that we're in right now to help these businesses. Because in many cases, the terms of these loans can be quite restrictive and make it quite difficult for these borrowers who really need the money to borrow. So a lot of it comes down to that. But it's great to know that there is money out there. I hope that any small business owner who's listening to this will be able to, you know, get into the show notes of this show and reach out to that particular provider and perhaps get a loan that they need to keep their doors open. But those types of ground level grassroots lending operations are absolutely vital now, even more vital than they were before, and particularly for minority owned businesses, which have found themselves really crimped during COVID and affected in a really, really bad way, simply because they tend to be in areas that are less wealthy, so therefore there's less money available to them to go through their doors to keep them open. So these types of loan programs are really, really important for them in particular.
Patty Hirsch is with us this morning's editor of the Planet Money podcast called The Indicator. That's from NPR. And we're talking about economics here on the morning show. We have another note now from Courtney. Courtney's a human resources manager with America's largest grocery chain. And Courtney says women are disproportionately represented in their workforce and also disproportionately paid. So we've talked about that. Courtney also says we've not received raises like our nursing counterparts throughout the pandemic. Courtney's had underpaid associates leave, and without guaranteed FMLA, many women may probably be forced to quit. So, Courtney, thank you so much for emailing that and helping us understand. You know, we focused a lot on nursing, but these other essential workers, like in grocery stores, the demand is high, but there are enough people maybe who are looking for jobs or willing to do it right now that grocery stores are not having to necessarily change what they're offering employees, and that will drive more women out of the workforce. Patty, what do you think about that?
Well, that's a really interesting encapsulation of the issue there. Overrepresented and underpaid. There are a lot of businesses where women find themselves in that situation. And you know, nursing and the care businesses are another example of that. I think that if you looked at home health care facilities where, you know, people are looking after sort of aged care, those types of facilities, again, you'll see women overrepresented and, again, probably underpaid. You know, what we hope is that the market will step in and solve this problem, right? So that if you have people leaving in those numbers, that you will see wages actually rise in those areas, because there's because demand kicks in. It's like, we really need these workers, so we're going to up the money that we pay them. That's what you hope will happen. You hope that the market will take over and do that. Unfortunately, in many cases, it seems that the market is not working as well as it should. And we are seeing, I mean, I have heard of pay rises at grocery stores because they are effectively essential workers, but I don't think they're as high as they might be. But again, we hope that the market will actually kick in and make that happen, that will force these employers to actually compensate their workers a little bit more generously because of the work that they are doing. But yes, that's a really, really good point. I mean, if you're a woman, you're in a business where you are, there are many women out there, and you feel that you're getting paid less than your male counterpart, why wouldn't you leave? Why wouldn't you say, you know, forget it, I'm just going to leave, and because, you know, I'm just not getting the respect that I deserve. And it comes down to that respect. So, you know, hopefully the market will correct this. You know, it hasn't so far, but it's only been 8 months. These are ships that tend to turn around very, very slowly. But that's what our hope is, that will happen and people will be compensated in the way that they should be.
You hit on that word, hope. It's time to break out your crystal ball, Patty. Are you optimistic, pessimistic? What do you see ahead for America's economy as we head into 2021?
I'm actually very optimistic. I think that this vaccine will get this. It's incredible to see how fast we have developed and started to distribute this vaccine. I mean, less than a year for a vaccine like this, that's absolutely incredible. I mean, it's a little scary that we're seeing mutations in this virus. You know, this virus that's the mutation that's coming in from the UK. It's like COVID with bad teeth, you know, the British virus. That's a little scary for us. But I think that generally we believe that this vaccine, once it kicks in and people start to take it, and we hope that people will take it, because that's another issue, is a lot of people are very untrusting of institutions now, much more than they used to be. And one of those institutions includes the healthcare system. So there'll be a lot of people who won't take this vaccine. But we hope that people will take this vaccine in large numbers, that they will begin to live their lives in a way that they used to, and we'll start to see that recovery happen. Because I think that when it does happen, it will accelerate very, very quickly. Because I think with a Democratic administration in place, right, with the Biden administration in place, they'll be much more willing to, you know, regardless of what Congress looks like, you're going to see a push towards getting more stimulus into the economy for a longer period than you might under a Republican administration. And I think that, you know, I think that that would be a good thing in the short term, not in the long term necessarily, but in the short term, that's what it's going to take. I think that that's what we're going to get, or more likely to get, with this administration. And that is going to be a good thing for everyone. So I'm actually pretty hopeful.
Mm. Patty, thank you for that perspective and for helping us break all of this down this hour. We appreciate your time.
Keely, it's been my pleasure. Thank you to all of your listeners who wrote in and asked questions. And a happy holidays to everyone, and a very, very safe and healthy new year.
You too. Thanks so much. Patty Hirsch is the editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. He's been an economics and finance news correspondent and editor for 20 years. And we've spent the hour talking about stimulus checks and clothing sales and job markets, and we've still only scratched the surface. Thanks for being with us on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to The Ideas Network.